Blog Talk Radio. Special edition of the Dragon Slayer. Tonight's topic is a continuation of my show 4, number 4, from last night that got cut off by Blog Talk Radio. I don't know why it happened. It was about 35 minutes into the third hour. Normally it records through the third hour, even though you can't hear the last hour live, but for whatever reason, cut me off. They've done that before. So, I'm here again tonight doing this instead of the other scheduled show that I had, which was to be music for Halloween. Now, what I'm going to try to do is this show was scheduled for 11:30 Central Time, PM, of course, which means it is technically an October 30th show. And I had the other one scheduled for tonight at this time, but I moved it till tomorrow, which will be the 31st. And so what I'm going to attempt to do, as long as I'm just not too sleepy to pull it off, is that when this show ends, I will immediately reschedule the show, the next one, for as soon as I can after the ending of this one. And as long as I can stay up, well, then I'll go ahead and pull it off. All I have to do is play music on the other show. And this one is going to be partially music as well. I'm in the middle of the last story of the book that I'm going to read. And I think I read all of the stories, actually. Then I was going to read the afterword and then a little short bio on the author and give the name of the book, the author's name, and where it can be found, and I was also going to read the back cover as well. And then I'm going to play, since I'm having to make another show out of it, a 30-minute long piece of some music that I doubt very many of you at all have heard. You may have heard the music, but you may not have heard it, heard this particular recording of it. And I'll just let that be a surprise until I get ready to play it. And then afterwards, I've got something else on the agenda that I can play that will last about 50, 55 minutes that I know most of the young people may not have heard. The older ones have heard it, but, you know, you may still be interested in hearing it again. And I'll announce what that is right before I get ready to play it. So, again, the show is on the paranormal. Setting is, this time, is not actually Russia. We've already kind of concluded that. This is Texas this time. And also, by the way, I've been having problems here with Blog Talk on trying to put information in on the show. It just won't let me put it in the way it needs to be. I don't know what the problem is. Maybe it's Mercury retrograde. I don't know. You know, Mercury goes retrograde 4 times a year, and communication and stuff like that just gets all piled up. You know, anything to do with Mercury information, you know, getting from point A to point B, not long trips, short trips. You know, trains run late, people are late to work. If they're normally late, they're later, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That may have something to do with it. I don't know. I've tried on 2 different computers. I'm just getting sick of it. You know, I only sit here and waste so much time. However, I will say this. Due to the problems with Blog Talk and some other things that I'll be getting into on another show that I'll wait till that show to mention it, but I'll probably be searching for the possibility of another format as long as I continue to do these sort of shows, and I will discuss that topic of doing these shows more deeply in another show. But anyway, the paranormal does not mean occult or supernatural. It has nothing to do with religion of any kind. The definition of the paranormal is that which demonstrably exists but lies outside the accepted normal of the society and culture that surrounds it. Therefore, it is to be investigated and not relegated to the realm of superstition. Let me clear my throat. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm not going to go back and read the whole thing. I mean, it was like 1, 2, almost 3 pages of what I read. You know, I just don't see any sense in it. You know, if you didn't catch the previous show, then you need to go hear the previous show. So, but I am going to start at the paragraph again where it stopped and the show stopped in the middle of it. And again, the title of this little story is called My Dark Angel. And let's see here. Oops, my bookmark just fell out. Okay, I probably don't need it. I got the pages dog-eared. And now the cigarette needs to be relit. Mercury retrograde. Okay. He is a young man in his early 30s. He is about 5 feet 7 inches tall with a medium build. He has sharp aquiline features and a large nose and wavy black hair that is usually cut short, but gives the impression he is slightly overdue for a haircut. He has a very neatly trimmed Van Dyke beard and a mustache and wears small round pince-nez glasses that are attached to the breast pocket of his jacket by a narrow black ribbon. Pince-nez. P-I-N-C-E-N-E-Z. I'm not sure what that is, to be honest. I'm sure I would know it if I saw it. But anyway. He wears a black double-breasted leather jacket with a military cut, belted with the epaulettes on the shoulders, and a white shirt, almost blindingly so in contrast to the rest of his clothing, and an old-fashioned bunch cravat necktie. His pants are black, tucked into the tops of his knee boots that have a very nice shine on them. He wears one glove on his left hand and carries the other. Michael Jackson thing, huh? The gloves are also what appears to be black leather. They are a thin dress glove, not worn for warmth. His black visor cap is also what I'd call a military style, but it's usually pushed back slightly, exposing his forehead and most of the time a shock of hair. He smokes. The smell of his cigarettes lingers in a room after he leaves. I also smoke, but the tobacco he uses is very strong and has a distinctive aroma. And again, just a reminder, this is the author's words, not mine. So every time I say I, it's in reference to the author here. So, let's see here. I was just wondering maybe if that was actually where I left off. I'm going to go back and read a couple of paragraphs prior to that. It doesn't change anything. But I'm just going to make sure. I just don't want to leave anything out. And then we'll come right back to where I just left off. And remember, he was saying that he had gone back to sleep. And so anyway, says he got up and followed, this time just in case I had my gun. When I got into the living room, it was empty. The door was still locked and bolted, and the rest of the house proved to be empty as well. I told my wife about it the next morning, and she wrote it off into a dream. It was not a dream. I was wide awake, and I had not been drinking, nor have I ever used any recreational substances. This was the first time I had seen my angel in many years, but it was not the last. He had remained completely unchanged over the years, both in dress and appearance. And then he just went into the... goes right into what I just read. He is not translucent or semi-visible. He manifests as a solid entity. In fact, his solid appearance almost got him shot that night in December of 1984. Not that I think he would have noticed. On that occasion, both while he was there and after he left, I had the strong feeling he was just looking in on me. Was there to see that everything was all right and to assure me everything would continue to be all right. It was a very peaceful, calm feeling. I did not see him again for several months. Then in March of 1985, shortly after the birth of my daughter, Megan, he came to see me again. This time we were living about 100 miles away in a town called Naples, Texas. This time the visit lasted only a minute or two. It was daylight, and I was sitting in my office reading. He came into the room, smiled at me, then left. It was daytime, and I was sitting in my office reading. He came into the room, smiled at me, then left. This time, when he was gone, I had the feeling I should cancel a meeting I had that afternoon and go home early instead. I did this, and when I got home, I found that not 5 minutes before, my son had fallen while playing, and my wife was getting ready to take him to the doctor. In December of 1989, I took the job that brought me to Russia. I will not mention the name of the company except to say that it was the oldest and largest company dealing with imaging technology in the world. About a week after arriving in Moscow, I moved into my flat, and that same night I received a visit. There he was, just like always, standing calmly in the living room, smiling at me. He only stayed a few seconds. He was gone almost as soon as I saw him. This time I had a single overpowering message running through my head. Welcome home. I had no way of knowing then that the temporary assignment I had undertaken would soon turn into Gilligan's 3-hour tour and that I would permanently make my home in Russia, marry here, and start my own business and a new family. So it was several years before I realized what this message meant. By the way, the dog is being a pest right at the moment. I may have to stop and remedy the situation. I scolded him before, and he insists on being a pest still. I will continue reading until it gets to be a problem. I met my wife in early 1991. Once, just after we met, we were at a local restaurant having dinner. While we were eating, I looked up and saw my dark angel standing beside my companion. He was smiling broadly and nodding his head. I looked at Veta to see if she was aware of him, and when I looked back up, he was gone. I guess it was his stamp of approval or his way of telling me this is the one, because we have been quite happy for more than 13 years. Veda is a believer. She never laughed or doubted my stories of my dark angel and has encouraged me to talk to her about his appearances. She trusts his warnings and messages as I do. It was several months before I saw him again. The next time he appeared to me was in early 1993. I was living in Moscow, and this appearance was also a very brief one. I was driving home from work and noticed him beside me in the car. I was surprised to see him, but not overly so. I was getting used to his visits. After about a minute, he disappeared. The message this time was, "Take the long way." I had been considering taking a side road home that would have taken several miles and about 15 minutes off of my commute. I didn't. When I saw the evening news that night, I was amazed. Well, not really, to find that a tanker truck had overturned on that road, killing the driver and the occupants of a car just behind him, stopping traffic and creating a dangerous chemical spill. I would have been caught right in the middle of it if I had taken the shortcut. In October of 1996, he visited it again. This would be his longest visit to date. I was in the States, living in Conroe, Texas. And by the way, Conroe is about 50 miles north of downtown Houston. Not far from the city limit, actually, but if you've been listening to any of my Texas shows, I've described how big the city of Houston is. So anyway, living in Conroe, Texas, with my wife and our kids in a second-floor apartment, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was soundly asleep when the smoke detector in our living room went off, waking my wife and me. I got up, went into the living room, turned off the alarm, and went on a quick tour of the flat. Finding no fire and no sign of smoke, I chalked it up to a bad battery and went back to bed. After 15 minutes later, it went off again with the same result. No fire, no smoke. I went back to bed again. This time, I couldn't go back to sleep. I lay there trying when the alarm went off for the third time. This time was different, however. Before I could get out of bed to turn it off, it stopped by itself. At the foot of our bed, our toy poodle, Cokie, started to growl and then to whimper. Cokie never thought of himself as a toy poodle. He envisioned himself as a miniature Rottweiler. He had an attitude. So when he growled, I didn't think it was odd. I thought he might have heard something outside. When he began to whimper, though, I became concerned. My wife was still asleep. I looked toward the foot of the bed, toward the dog, and there he was, my dark angel, leaning calmly against the wall, smoking a cigarette and looking at me. He grinned, more of a lopsided smirk than a grin. When he saw I had noticed him and nodded, at this time, our little dog got very quiet and still and then started wagging his tail. After about 5 minutes, during which we simply stared at each other, he departed. This time I actually saw him go. He had been standing backlit by our bedroom window. It was very light in the room. The drapes and shades were open. There was a full moon, and the street light outside in the parking lot was on. In short, while there were no lights on inside the apartment, it was almost light enough to read and absolutely light enough to make out every detail of my visitor. In no time has he ever spoken to me. Several times I have tried to speak to him, but I've always gotten the strong mental impression it is somehow against the rules, and I am fixing to scold me a dog. So, sorry about that, but I'm going to play another song, and I will deal with this situation, and I will be right back. Okay, I'm back. Me and this guy have been rounding around about certain issues for a long time now. And believe me, as much as I love him, if I could just give him to somebody else at this point, I probably would. He's a German Shepherd, but I think he's one of the dumbest German Shepherds I've ever seen in my life. I mean, don't get me wrong, he's really smart. But when it comes to learning something, he refuses to learn it. Yeah. And he's too smart for his own good. And that's why I say he's dumb. Sometimes being smart can be dumb. So, anyway, where was I at? Let's see here. In no time has he ever spoken to me. Several times I have tried to speak to him, but I've always gotten the strong mental impression it is somehow against the rules. After each encounter with him, I have had the lasting impression he is there to look after me out of some sort of duty or obligation, and that he has been watching me, members of my immediate family, for a long time. This time he smiled at me, touched the visor of his cap, which was pushed far back on his forehead to expose a shock of unruly hair that hung over his forehead, turned and walked out the closed window. I could see him walking. As he did, he appeared to grow smaller with distance. As I stated earlier, I lived on the second floor, yet he walked away as though he were on level ground and not 15 feet or so above it. Unlike most of his previous visits and one that would follow, this visit did not produce any warning or other message, only a feeling of peace and a sense I was being watched over. After he left, my wife stirred and sat up suddenly. She looked upset and asked me shakily what had happened. It was then I discovered she had not been asleep at all. She told me she had been wide awake, but unable to either move or open her eyes. We talked about this around the breakfast table an hour or so later, and it was then that I got one of the biggest surprises of my life. My son Eric, who was then 15, overheard us and stated, rather matter-of-factly, "Oh, that's just Yasha. He came to see me last night, too." He went on to tell us he had seen our visitor often. He had, in fact, been seeing him for as long as he could remember. I was stunned. I had never had a name for my visitor. I'd always just thought of him as my dark angel. Needless to say, I was genuinely curious about the one Eric used for him. I had never heard a name like that before, anywhere. It was certainly strange to me, and it would have been under any circumstances, let alone these. Need to clear my throat. Hold on. I asked Eric where he had learned it, and he said he told me his name when I was real little. He said that he was my friend, and he was there to look out for me, and that he didn't want me to be afraid of him. In the space of about 10 minutes, I learned that Eric's earliest recollections of him were like my own. From the time he had been about 4 or 5 years old, among his earliest memories were of a man in black clothes and shiny boots who came to watch him while he slept. I asked my son why he had never told me about it before, and he said he told me not to. He said that nobody would believe me, but it feels like it's okay to talk about him now. It's like he wants me to. I asked Eric if Yasha had ever talked to him out loud, and he told me no, that he could feel or hear the conversations in his head. I'd never spoken with my daughters, Megan, who is now 20 years old, and her sister, Heather, who is almost 18, about my visitor. So I don't know if he's ever visited them or not. I suspect that he has, yet for some reason the subject has just never come up. I have intended to speak with them about him several times, but each time it seems that something arises to prevent the conversation from taking place. I have no idea why, but it's almost as though I'm not supposed to discuss this with them. I can't help but wonder if the same thing has happened to them. I know that both of them are sensitive, although neither is as sensitive as Eric and I are. Let me light my cigarette. In 1998, I was on a work assignment in Nagambo, Sri Lanka, and my angel came for a brief visit as I was walking down the beach near my house. This visit lasted only a minute or two. We literally met on the beach, walking in opposite directions, passed each other silently, and went on our separate ways. He simply nodded and smiled at me as we passed. This time the message was, "Don't." I had been planning to take a quick swim, but after meeting with my dark angel, decided against it. I later found that the waters near our beach had been invaded by jellyfish that evening, something that happens often here at completely unpredictable times, and that several swimmers had been stung, one of whom died. I have no idea why this entity comes to me and some members of my family. I thought it at first might be the spirit of some deceased family member, but have found no evidence of this. Now, I've discreetly questioned my mother and father, who is now deceased, as to whether we have or had anyone in the family who resembled my angel, and their answer was, "Not to our knowledge." It seems to be from an earlier time than our own. His clothing indicates the early 20th century or the late 19th. Call it anywhere between about 1890 and 1920 or so, and he seems to have once been a military man of some kind, judging from the style of his clothing, except there is no sign of a badge or other insignia except for a small emblem on the front of his cap just above the visor. When I described him to my wife, she told me that the clothing reminded her of pictures she had seen in her history books at school, then dug through the ones that we had at home until she found something that was similar. My wife says his clothes reminds her of the uniform of the early commissars, the notorious political officers of the Soviet Cheka, predecessor to the NKVD and later KGB. I have since found many photographs that tend to support this, but at the time he first appeared to me, now almost 50 years ago, and most of the times to follow, I had no knowledge of this, had never set foot in Russia, and never planned to do so. Now whenever I find an old book or a bunch of old pictures, I look through them carefully to see if I can find a familiar face. So far I haven't, but in time, who knows? My question is, what connection does this being have with me and my family? Why is he looking after us? Honestly, I don't know. I just know he is with us, and from what I have seen, will be for some time to come. I'm glad he is. And okay, let me go to the section in the back where I lost my bookmark earlier. And let me clear my throat real quick. Okay. Let me get these glasses back on. I almost dropped the book here. All right, this is called The Afterword. Hope that all of you, my readers, have enjoyed these accounts of the paranormal in Russia. These are not the famous cases, but rather those events that are seen, observed, and talked about every day in practically all parts of the country. They are just a few of the stories, all completely documentable, that I could have included in this collection. Quite literally, if you have to wear a good scary... wear. Quite literally, if you want to hear a good scary story, ask a Russian. There is assuredly no shortage, and there is no shortage of those willing to tell them, or amazingly enough, of proof to verify such accounts. One of the first things that any Westerner, particularly an American, learns when he or she comes to this country is that most Russians not only believe in the paranormal, but believe in it very strongly. Hand in hand with this belief is an openness, a willingness to discuss and actively investigate such matters that we of the West find truly amazing. There are several reasons for this phenomenon, but essentially it is part of the Russian culture and Russian way of thinking. Russia is a very large and very old country. It spans the entire European and Asian continents and has been a settled nation for far more than 2,000 years. For most of that time, it had a widely scattered and mostly rural population that was deeply rooted in the folk religions and isolated folk cultures of specific regions. Such incidents were talked about over campfires around the hearth and spread by word of mouth throughout the entire nation. Later, as Russia matured and sought to shake off the superstitions of the past, rather than suppress such stories, an active effort was made to investigate them and to disprove them. Russians, however, are notoriously obstinate people in a good sense, and once something has been established as true in their viewpoint, it is almost impossible to shake that belief. This is the reason why 80 years of communism found it completely impossible to eradicate the superstition of religion, and why even today Russians are still among the most devoutly religious people in the world. So the efforts of various Russian and Soviet governments to disprove what they considered superstition had a slightly different effect than planned. All across the country, both official and unofficial bodies sprang up that were devoted to the scientific and systematic investigation and documentation of any and all such claims of paranormal activity. Investigations were held with military and police-like precision, and documentation in literal sheaves and batches was accumulated. People were not only asked, but actively encouraged to talk about, discuss, but more importantly, to report any paranormal event or occurrence they witnessed or had any first or even second-hand knowledge of. The files grew and the bulk of material became mountainous. As time passed, a completely different definition of the paranormal developed in Russia. It was no longer seen as occult or supernatural. It was Russia that developed the first truly comprehensive and scientific concept of the paranormal, and it is something that all Russians are extremely proud to have been the moving force behind. As you read the articles in this collection, you have found that definition to be an integral part of each piece. Here in Russia, the paranormal is defined as that which demonstrably exists but lies outside the accepted normal of the culture and society that surrounds it. As an investigator, I feel this is the best possible definition of the term. In time, if this concept is ever generally adopted on a worldwide basis, it will be the single most effective tool in raising the investigation of the paranormal beyond the realm of the parlor medium and pseudoscientists and into legitimate status as a serious investigation of known but highly unusual phenomena. In closing, there is one other concept that most Westerners have of Russia that is completely and totally inaccurate. I will once again touch on the subject of Russians and religion. For years, Russia was viewed as an atheistic nation that defined religion as the opiate of the people. Nothing is farther from the truth. More than 80% of all Russians not only believe, but believe strongly in their various faiths. Because of this, rather than view the paranormal, especially the existence of spirit entities, as something that is impossible or inconsistent with their faith, they consider such things positive proof that their faith, whatever it may be, has been proven beyond doubt. They see it as definite evidence that the human spirit, the soul, if you will, not only survives but transcends death. For the average Russian, this is more than reason enough to believe it in and to investigate the paranormal and to accept its literal existence. Signed, Dr. J. Lee Sharon, Moscow, October 2nd, 2006. And that is Dr. James Lee Sharon, and that is spelled C-H-O-R-O-N, James L. Sharon. That is not the same spelling as Ariel Sharon, okay? Now, this guy is definitely a white guy. In fact, he is of Russian descent, I believe, or at least partially so. About the author, James L. Sharon is a journalist and writer living in Mamontovka, a suburb of Moscow, Russia. He has resided in the Russian Federation for more than 17 years and is a former senior executive with the Eastman Kodak Company. He is currently owner and chief executive officer of Old Guard Productions, a company dealing in motion picture and television logistics and properties, and American Business Training, a company that deals with sales and customer service training for Russian companies seeking to introduce Western business practices and standards. He was born in Dallas, Texas in December 1953, so he's about 7 years older than me, and raised in the small East Texas town of Center, where his parents still reside. He is a graduate of Center High School and Stephen F. Austin State University, where he received a bachelor's degree in history. He is also a graduate of Moscow State University with a master's degree and a PhD in the same subject, as well as a graduate degree in optical engineering. Dr. Sharon has been a working journalist for slightly more than 35 years and has columns appearing in numerous publications in both Russia and the United States. He has numerous hobbies, primarily related to paranormal and historical research, both of which he has been involved in for more than 35 years. He has published a number of independent articles on paranormal encounters and activities, as well as on historical topics, and is a staff member with several online publications and forums dealing with history and the paranormal. And the name of the book is called Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia by James L. Sharon. And it is was originally published in 2007 by Zumaya Publications, LLC. And when you do a search for that, like in Amazon, is one of the better places, I believe, you can find it. You might can find it at Barnes & Noble. I don't know. Let me clear my throat real quick. When you do a search for it, be sure to include the last part of that title, because there are other books called Footprints in the Snow. So again, Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia, James L. Sharon, and that's Chroon. And I went to Amazon a little earlier and saw that some were there, and it's got a 2009 date to it, so that must be a second printing of books. And on the back, it's categorized as body/mind/spirit/parapsychology/general. And the back cover says, "Welcome to Russia, the most haunted nation on earth. They are the damned, the forgotten, those who cry out to let us know they lived. They are all ages and all sexes. They remain earthbound for many reasons: duty, devotion, a sense of responsibility, but most of all, for the simplest and most compelling reason of all, love. Come explore the vast land that is Russia, from the metropolitan streets of Moscow to the windswept steppes and far-flung plains of Siberia. Discover the strange tales of those whose lives have continued long after their bodies perished, and whose restless spirits yet leave footprints in the Russian snows." Footprints in the Snow, the Stories of Haunted Russia, is a reporter's view of documentable paranormal incidents. The stories are told through the eyes of a professional skeptic, one who does not see ghosts behind every tree. Statistically, more than 96% of all such stories turn out to be quite natural in origin. There are exceptions. And I hope everybody enjoyed that book. And I think if you purchase it, you will not be disappointed. I think it's under $15. I don't remember what the exact price was, but it's probably a little bit higher than when I bought mine in 2007. There are plenty of reviews there as well. And, you know, if you would like to leave a review of the book there, I'm sure he would appreciate it. And I'm sure that if you leave a review, it's because you were happy with what you read or heard. So anyway, what I'm going to do here next is I've got 30-minute long instrumental of a tune that is called Echoes, originally by Pink Floyd. Well, this is a cover of it, and I doubt anybody has probably, or any of my audience at least, has heard this version of it. Actually, it's 24 minutes and 13 seconds. And so I'm going to go ahead and play this. I think everyone will enjoy it. And then I will come back on afterwards and tell you what I have for the last part of the show. So I will be back shortly. Enjoy. Okay, I'm back. I hope everybody enjoyed that. I wasn't sure when a good time to play that was going to ever be because it's so long, and I wound up having to do this extra show, and given the day of the year that it is, I thought it appropriate. So, nevertheless, and I wanted to mention too, by the way, that I put a picture up of the cover of James's book on Blog Talk on the Blog Talk Radio page. It is one of the rotating images that you will see on there, so you know what it looks like when you get ready to order it. And again, I'm going to try and have him on as a guest at some point in the very near future. And he's been involved in this movement longer than I have. He's a little bit older than me. And of course, he's been in Russia now for a long time. And I thought maybe he could also give us some insight into some things over there, as well as what he observed when David Duke had gone over there. I don't know which trip it was that he, I don't know if he actually met him or just saw him from a distance or what, but we'll get the lowdown when the time comes. So we will have him on at some point. It's just a matter of when, but I'm going to try and have him on sometime in the near future while all of this stuff is fresh on everybody's mind. So what I've got next here, I didn't want to end the show at 90 minutes, and this next piece is 52 minutes, 45 seconds, and so it will go past the two-hour point, but, if you are listening live and you want to catch the end of it, you can call in to hear the last bit of it right before the show ends and just listen over the phone. And otherwise, you'll have to catch it in the archives. And I will probably play one short song afterwards just to end the show. And that should put this, it's about 5 minutes till one my time. And so the show should end shortly around 2, I guess around 2 o'clock or shortly before. And I'm going to see if I can schedule the next show with the music around 2:30 if Block Talk will let me. I think I have to actually end the show before I can actually change the beginning time on the next one that's scheduled. It is all music. I have 3 hours worth of music. If you are up and you want to catch it, well, then you'll be able to catch at least 2 hours of it. And, of course, you'll be able to hear it if you call in for the last hour. But hopefully it would be something people would want to listen to during the day tomorrow, or if you're going to be at home tomorrow night and just feel like listening to some music appropriate for the time, then you can listen to it then or just whatever. I think everybody will enjoy it. And it's just a collection of different pieces. Some of them are instrumental and some of them are actually songs. What I've got next is H.G. War of the Worlds. Not something I necessarily would have ever planned to play, but again, I didn't want to make this just a 90-minute show, and I didn't have any other books that were similar to what I was reading that I would have read. I'm not much of a fiction reader. I really don't care for fiction. To me, fiction is a movie. It's over in 2 hours. Most fiction has too many adverbs and adjectives. Of course, I don't consider Jim's book fiction, but in a sense, it would be like someone writing fictional stories. But I can deal with Jim's book. Most fiction is just, to me, junk. All the adverbs and adjectives are just fluff. You can say the same damn thing in about one-third of the words if you get rid of the fluff. It's like, get to the damn point. Most fiction is just purely a waste of time. Anyway, for you young people out there, if you have not heard this, this was an old radio broadcast, and I'm not going to give the details of it away, but at the time when it was played, a lot of people were unaware that it was not real. And some people tuned in, thought, oh my gosh, this is happening. And they panicked. And a lot of Americans went and got their guns and went outside and started looking for something to shoot because they thought it was real. And for your older folks, you probably have heard it by now, but maybe you're willing to give it another listen. A lot of places will, when I say places, radio stations or whatever, have been in the habit in the past of playing this around this time of year. And so I thought, since I do have somewhat of a younger audience, that they may not have heard this, and this would be a good way to expose them to it. So this is 52 minutes, 45 seconds. And again, I'll come back and I'll play another song afterwards. So hopefully it won't be too corny for you. And if it is, maybe you'll still get a kick out of it. So anyway, I'll be back in about 53 minutes or so.
Warning! Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Reaches South Street. Gas masks useless. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use Route 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas. Smoke now spreading over Raymond Boulevard.
Of panic, the blind, unreasoning terror of men who run and do not truly know what they are fleeing. And this is the factual story of such a panic. Good evening. I'm Ed Morrow, and this is the story of the night America trembled. It was October 30th, 1938, a night rather like other October nights in other years, except for perhaps two factors. First, it was a year in which the nations of the world, at peace for almost 20 years, had recently seen shattered their comfortable illusion of security. 2,000 miles away, across an ocean now realized to be no longer a safeguard against invasion, the arrogant demands of a power-hungry dictator had short weeks before forced haughty Britain and proud France to agree to the humiliating peace of Munich. Thus, point one, that world events had left men shaken and unsure, hence open to emotional attack against their reason, against their intelligence, and their logic. Point two is somewhat harder to accept, but it's equally valid. It can be traced back countless centuries, beyond civilized mankind's reasoned fear of war, to primitive man's instinctive terror of the great unknown. For October 30th was that mysterious night when dark tradition tells us fiends and demons walk the winds of the world. The one night of the year when even sensible men believe that almost anything can happen. The eve of Halloween, 1938. And in a radio studio of the Columbia Broadcasting System in New York City, the actors and staff of the Mercury Theater on the Air were putting the final touches to what was frankly a terror tale, which was to go on the air within a few short minutes. We see them now in the final moments of rehearsal with their director.
Page 19, that hissing, humming sound. I'd like you to mix in the hum a little bit faster and build it more than you did the dress. Can you do it?
Okay, I'll do it.
Okay, let's try it.
Phillips?
19?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
About here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. As I can see it now, it's a white handkerchief tied to a pole, a flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means... No, wait! Wait, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Good Lord, they're turning to flame.
Well, that ought to scare the daylight out of them. It does me, and I've been rehearsing it for hours.
You never can tell. Radio listeners are pretty blasé now. Bill?
Yes, sir.
The sequence where you're calling old stations, the CQ call.
Page 28?
Yeah. Now, build that a shade more. You think you're the last man alive on Earth, so let's have a little more desperation, huh?
I don't want to ham it up.
Well, it's pure fantasy. Play with all the stops out, okay?
Okay.
All right. 15 minutes?
Right.
In October of 1938, the Columbia Broadcasting System radio network consisted of 110 affiliated stations in 44 states. There was practically no sizable community in America which could not be reached by CBS broadcast. Thus, from Maine to California and from Canada to the Gulf, listeners were tuned to the Mercury Theater on that fateful night. In the eastern United States, the area closest to the scene of fictitious peril, reaction was most vivid and violent. However, it should be remembered that in their behavior, these easterners were not unique. Everywhere, emotions and reactions were the same. Panic struck universally out of the dark but peaceful sky on a night that began quietly enough.
Bob.
Good evening, Miss Morgan.
Come on in. Mary will be down in a minute.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Morgan.
Hello, Bob. Nice out?
Yes, sir. It's swell.
Getting chilly?
No, it's just right. Perfect football weather.
You see the game yesterday?
You bet I did. 14-0.
Pretty good team this year, huh?
Seventh in the national ratings. We ought to be first, too. We haven't even been scored on yet.
Those seven Iron Dukes. Think they'll make the Rose Bowl?
Well, I'll tell you, I think if we can get by Syracuse and Pitt, we got a good chance.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ben.
Sorry to keep you waiting.
That's okay. We got plenty of time. Second show doesn't start for an hour.
Oh, where are we going?
I thought maybe the Rialto.
Oh, what's playing there?
Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire and Carefree. You seen it?
No, but I'd love to. Good night, Dad.
Bob, don't keep her out too late.
No, sir.
Good night, Mom.
Good night, dear. Night, Bob.
Good night, Miss Morgan.
What's on tonight, Dad?
What time is it?
Oh, getting on to 8.
CBS, the Mercury Theater, NBC, Edgar Bergen, and Charlie McCarthy.
Charlie McCarthy. I like him. Let's listen to that.
You know, you take now a punk like this Hitler, all spit and polish, the mob yelling hail every time he wipes his nose. A guy like him don't raise an army just for the fun. Mark my words, there's going to be trouble. Maybe even sooner than you think.
Hitler's just a big bag of wind.
Oh, I don't know about that now.
Yes, Phyllis. He already grabbed Austria and Czechoslovakia, ain't he? Now he's got his eye on Poland.
A big bag of wind. Everybody made the mistake was they never should have buckled under him from the beginning. If they just told him to go jump in the lake, well, what could he do? Huh? Huh? France on the west, Russia on the east, Mussolini in the south. He can't move a muscle in any direction.
Yeah, he could go up.
Up?
Yeah. Hit all of a sudden from the air, anywhere he likes. America, even.
America?
Sure, why not?
I'd like to see him try to bomb this country.
Yeah, you maybe, but not me. Because he just might get away with it. I don't want to be nowhere around when the bomb starts falling.
You know, you sound like them Europeans. They're all too yellow to call us bluff.
Yellow? What do you mean yellow, huh?
Well, I just said...
Yeah, I heard what you said. You think I'm yellow, is that it?
Now, wait a minute.
Come on.
Now,
let go of me. How about that? You think I'm yellow?
Now, look, you two. I don't want no trouble here.
Lay off, will you?
I didn't mean you. I just meant anybody who won't stand up and fight for his country.
Yeah. I'll fight for my country, same as the next guy. Don't think nothing different, eh?
That's the baby center?
I imagine.
Good.
What's your hurry? It's not 8 yet.
Well, I'm hungry.
Oh, thirsty me.
Huh. Evening, Mrs. Chandler. I'm not late, am I?
No, Millie, right on time.
Is the baby in bed?
Mm-hmm. And asleep. You remember when to feed him?
Yes, ma'am. 10 o'clock.
Right. The bottle's in the refrigerator. You remember how to warm it up?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I left milk and sandwiches in the refrigerator, too. So help yourself. We won't be gone too long.
I'll be all right, Mrs. Chandler. I brought my homework, so I've got plenty to do till you get back.
Yeah, well, hold down the fort, Millie.
We'll be at the country club. I left the phone number on the telephone pad in case you need it. We'll get along just fine. Good night, Millie. Good night, Mrs. Chandler.
Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliates present the Mercury Theater on the air in War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Gentlemen, the host of the Mercury Theater. We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
Any action, Mike?
Not a thing. Get the coffee?
Yeah. You said black, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
It's yours, then.
Thanks. 154, calling PD-1. 154, calling PD-1. 154, this is PD-1. Come in.
Mac, give me a rundown of New Jersey license 3F92. Repeat, New Jersey license 3F92.
Rundown on New Jersey license 3F92. Will do. Hold on.
Wainwright again.
Who else?
Does he think they're all stolen cars? He calls in about 20 a night.
That's what you call an obsession.
He reads too much Dick Tracy.
That could be.
PD-1, calling 154.
Go ahead, PD-1.
Description, New Jersey license 3F92. 1936 blue two-door old sedan. Registration A. 387564. Motor G. 148690. Owner Horace Adams. 1407 West Boulevard, Camden. You got it?
Got it. Thanks, Mac.
Right.
A real eager beaver.
Well, you gotta have somebody like him to keep you awake a night like this.
Yeah, I suppose. Sunday nights are usually pretty dull after Labor Day.
Pretty dull. You know, I took this job because I thought it was going to be exciting.
On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Ratings Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
For the next 24 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia, causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature, 66, minimum, 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We now take you to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza in New York City, we bring you the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra. And, with a touch of the Spanish, Ramon Raquello leads off with La Comparsita.
Thanks, Tommy. Whittaker, you writing that Rocky Mount crash?
Yep. Almost finished.
How much copy you got on it?
Column and a half, maybe.
Build it to two columns. I got a good picture here and a double column spot on the front page.
Okay. There's not really much to it. No serious injuries.
Yeah. Could use a good lead story. All I've got is a community fund report. That's the trouble on Sunday night. Nothing ever happened.
That's right. That's the trouble with Sunday nights in the news business. Nothing ever happens. These people are comfortable, relaxed. You might say even bovine in their smug complacency. It's a Sunday night like other Sunday nights. Quiet, uneventful. America is at peace. There's no threat of war. They have no way of dreaming that within a few short minutes, their complacency is to be rudely shattered by an actor's voice speaking lines from a play.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
The opening words, the words that shook a nation.
At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and described the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
One troubled face out of 10. But this is the face of dawning panic on the night America trembled.
And now a word from John Cameron Swayze.
Ladies and gentlemen, a good evening to you.
When scientists learned to split the atom, they found that it released something. It was energy in the form of heat. But it wasn't much from just one atom. So they set up a chain reaction like this. They found that it made the greatest physical force mankind has ever developed. And they called it atomic fission. Now, less than 10 years ago, the Atomic Energy Commission turned to the nation's industry to harness the power of the atom and make it work for people in peacetime. Engineers, scientists, and technicians got together at Westinghouse to tackle the toughest job in technical history. And they succeeded. They produced usable atomic energy, the kind that drove the submarine Nautilus over 60,000 miles without refueling. And that's only the beginning of a bright new world. Later this year, many of the lights of Pittsburgh will be lit with still another Westinghouse-built reactor, the Shippingport Power Plant, a joint venture with Duquesne Light Company and the Atomic Energy Commission. And if you wonder what putting atomic energy to work means to you, here's the man who can answer your question. He's the man who set up the Atomic Power Division of Westinghouse, Mr. Charles Weaver, Vice President for Atomic Power.
Thank you, John. Today, atomic power isn't just a hope. It's as much a fact as coal and oil. Just as coal and oil started new industrial progress, atomic energy marks the beginning of a new era, with new comforts, new power to get where you want to go and do what you want to do. Putting this new atomic force to useful work is a source of great satisfaction to us at Westinghouse.
Yes? In atomic power, too, Westinghouse is first with the future.
The night America trembled. We are bringing you the true story of the most memorable dramatic broadcast in the history of radio. The Mercury Theater's unforgettable dramatization of War of the Worlds. The broadcast has just begun. Its effect is not yet beginning to make itself felt in the cities and hamlets of a nation soon to be caught in the grip of ungovernable terror.
Now a tune that never loses favor. The ever-popular Stardust, Ramon Raquello and his orchestra.
The country to keep an astronomical watch on any further disturbances occurring on the planet Mars. Due to the unusual nature of this occurrence, we have arranged an interview with the noted astronomer, Professor Pearson, who will give us his views on the subject. In a few moments, we will take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, New Jersey. We return you until then to the music of Ramon Raquello and his orchestra.
Who cares? You turn that off. Turn it off. I'm studying. You want to study? Go up to your own room.
I'm the gregarious type, okay?
You happy? This is good as a movie?
Better. Look, the shooting star.
Hey, that was a bright one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just look out there. Look at those stars. They look so close. You feel you can just reach right up and touch them.
Sure, you can. Do you want to answer?
You're crazy.
Crazy about you. Mary?
Mm-hmm.
I got something for you today.
What?
This. Well, how about it?
What will my parents say?
Well, you know what they'll say. They'll say we're too young, too immature, but they've been saying that for a year. What do you say? Shall we? Tonight, right now.
I'd like to, Bob, but...
What's the matter? Aren't you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
Well, then... I know a justice of the peace, and we could be there in an hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, a special announcement from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object,
believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Elizabeth. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene, and will have our commentator, Mr. Phillips, give you a word description as soon as he can reach there from Princeton. In the meantime, we take you to the Hotel Martinet in Brooklyn, where Bobby Millett and his orchestra are offering a program of dance music.
Couldn't be. New Jersey's 500 miles north.
We take you now to Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again at the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in just 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin to paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes.
I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree it must have struck on the way down. Now, what I can see of the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not like the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. The color is sort of yellowish-white.
Curious spectators now are pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. One man wants to touch the thing. He's having an argument with a policeman. And the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen. You hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. Now, I'll move the microphone closer. Now, here we are. Now, we're not more than, 25 feet away. Can you hear it now?
Hello? Oh, hello, Molly. No, I'm just waiting here for Paul and his wife. We're going to church. The radio? No, I haven't. Why? What? Well, just for a minute, perhaps. Thanks, Molly.
The thing is smooth and, as you can see, of cylindrical shape.
Just a minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off.
The top is beginning to rotate like a screw. The thing must be hollow.
Hey, she's a-moving. The darn thing's unscrewing.
Keep back there. Keep back, I tell you.
Hey, maybe there's men in it trying to escape.
It's red hot. They'll burn to a cinder.
Keep back there. Keep those idiots back. She's off! The top's loose! Look out there!
Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I have ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling out of the hollow top. Someone or something I can see peering out of that black hole, two luminous disks. Are they eyes? It might be a face. It might be... Good heavens, something's wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another. And another. They look like tentacles to me. There, I can see the thing's body. It's as large as a bear, and it glistens like wet leather. The face, it's indescribable. I can hardly
force myself to keep looking at it. The eyes are black.
I'm going to turn the
corner. Oh, look, please. Look,
Bob. Look, please. The shape of saliva dripping from its rim. Okay. Lips that seem to quiver and pulsate. The monster, or whatever it is, can hardly move. It seems weighted down by muscles.
Oh, horrible.
I'm Juan City Desk.
A what? Wait a minute. Hey, Johnny, you got anything on the wire about a meteor falling in New Jersey? No, ma'am. We haven't got anything on it. Nothing at all. No, ma'am. Don't mention it. What do you suppose is ailing her?
Why? What's up?
She said she heard something on the radio about a meteor landing in New Jersey carrying Martian monsters. Boy, people.
So, the Mercury Theater on the air blithely proceeds with its dramatization of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. The actors, of course, have no way of knowing their performance is sowing the seeds of panic amongst hundreds of thousands who believe they're actually hearing a factual report. But others are beginning to feel its impact. For instance, the officers on duty at the State Police and Fire Dispatcher's Office in Trenton, New Jersey.
State Police. No, sir, we don't know anything about that. Sir, there is no Grover's Mill in New Jersey. There's a Grovesville, but there's no Grover's Mill. I can't help it, sir, what the radio says. There's no such place. State Police. No, ma'am, we don't know anything about that. Well, I can't help that, ma'am. We just don't know anything about it.
Brother, did I say something about a quiet Sunday evening?
What's going on, anyway?
I don't know. They say it's been announced on the radio. You better check.
State Police. No, sir, we have no information on that. Sorry.
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Groversville, New Jersey. Meanwhile,
that must be it.
What the hell's he talking about? Grover's Mill. There's no such place.
Maybe it's just a play or something.
We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill. Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am back at the stone wall that adjoins Mr. Woolman's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk, as long as I can see. More state police have arrived.
More state police?
They're drawing up a horse in front of the pit.
State police. No, sir, we have no information on that yet. We're checking it now.
All right. Just wait till next year, you'll see. Oh, next year, next year. Always next year. The Dodgers ain't won a pennant since 1920.
That means they ain't never going to win another, eh?
Probably.
Boy, I wish I knew all the answers like you do, you know.
Come on, you guys. Why are you two always arguing?
Mike, have you heard?
Heard what?
About the Martian. A spaceship full of Martians landed near Trenton, 50 miles from here. It's on the radio now.
Martians?
Well, that's what the guy said.
What guy?
Well, some guy on the radio, some professor from Princeton. The state cops are out there now.
The captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. Yes, I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole, a flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means... Wait, wait, something's happening.
A hump shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Good Lord, they're turning into flame. Now the whole field's caught fire. The woods, the barns, the gas tanks of automobiles, it's spreading everywhere. It's coming this way, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
Evidently, there is some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return you to that spot at the earliest opportunity.
Well, come on.
In the meantime...
What? Come on, we got to get down there fast. I got a car.
California. Down where?
Down to Grover's Mill.
Well, where's Grover's Mill?
Somewhere near Trenton, I think.
Oh, now, wait a minute, fellas. We don't know what this is all about.
Oh, don't know. It's like I told you. It's the Nazis.
The guy on the radio said it was monsters for Mars.
It's Nazi air raids. Come on. Come on. Hey, you guys. Wait for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have just been handed a message that came from Grover's Mill by telephone. Just a moment.
Who's Deal?
Speak up. Anybody interested in Volker anymore?
Todd, this is important. Listen.
At least 40 people, including six state troopers, lie dead in a field east of Grover's Mill, their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition. Ladies and gentlemen, the next voice you hear will be that of Brigadier General Montgomery Smith, commander of the state militia at Trenton, New Jersey.
Trenton, that's where my family lives.
Listen, listen.
I have been requested by the governor of New Jersey to place the counties of Mercer and Middlesex as far west as Princeton and east to Jamesburg under martial law. Four companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening
sure,
to...
Sure, you hear that? They're calling out the army.
Hey, my folks, I think I better call.
Now, take it easy, Buzz. All right.
How do you know? I'm going to call.
Mail are coming in. A strange creature...
Trenton, how far is that from here?
Back
a couple hundred miles. Come on, let's play cards.
Huh?
Well, hear me out. I don't want to play.
Combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside. We have been unable to establish any contact with our mobile unit at Grover's Mill. But we hope to be able to return you there at the earliest possible moment.
Something moving, solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair rising up out of the cylinder. It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Now it's reaching above the trees and the searchlights are on it. Hold on!
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our own eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars.
Mars?
Bob, turn around. Go back. Bob, I want to go home.
And now, back from vacation, here's Betty Furness. Welcome back, Betty.
Thank you. It's very nice to be back. And now, I want to show you an exciting new symbol. And here it is. The symbol that represents the very newest ideas in home appliances. New design, new performance. It's the shape of tomorrow from Westinghouse. And now, here's the exciting shape of tomorrow in brand new 1958 Westinghouse laundry equipment, the 1958 Spacemate. Here, you'll find the shape of tomorrow in this modern new design. The shape of tomorrow, a new convenience, too. Imagine a clothes dryer that operates right on top of the laundromat and takes up only 25 inches of space. And look, now push-button control for the most accurate washing and drying yet. And here is the exciting new custom Imperial laundromat and dryer. You'll see the shape of tomorrow in this style light control panel that lights up like this. Push-button controls that give 5 wash and 2 rinse temperatures. And that same stunning control panel lights up this twin electric clothes dryer. Push-button controls here, too, give you just the right drying for every kind of fabric. And here, the shape of tomorrow means the very last word in convenience in this beautiful Westinghouse wash and dry combination. It takes just 2 minutes of your time to load clothes and set the dials. And your clothes are beautifully washed and properly dried, all automatically. In every laundromat, there's the famous revolving agitator that washes cleaner, rinses better, and even cleans itself. and every dryer has new, improved, direct airflow drying. See the 1958 Westinghouse Shape of Tomorrow laundromats and dryers now. The most advanced and the most complete line of home laundry equipment made today. And remember, too, you can be sure if it's Westinghouse.
October 30th, 1938, the night America trembled. The impact of the Mercury Theater's broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds is as devastating as it is unexpected. The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations, the newspapers, the police and fire departments of the whole nation, all are being deluged by a Niagara of calls from frenzied listeners who believe the radio drama to be the real thing. More than a million listeners from coast to coast are caught in the grip of a contagious mass hysteria, and they flee in terror from an incredible bogeyman, mythical invaders from the planet Mars.
Strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray.
Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report three Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them.
Heat ray not in use. Although advancing at express train speed, invaders pick their way carefully. One moment, please. Here is a bulletin from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Coon hunters have stumbled on a second cylinder similar to the first, embedded in the great swamp 20 miles
Hello?
South of Morris.
Hello? Is this the country club? I want to speak to Mr. or Mrs. Chandler. And hurry. Please hurry.
The can be opened, and the fighting machine rings. They are taking a position in the foothills.
Hello? Mr. Chandler, this is Millie. Can you come home, please, right away? No, the baby's all right. It's the Martians. Yes, Martians. You mean you haven't heard? Oh, Mr. Chandler, it's all over the radio. Awful things are happening. The Martians have landed in New Jersey with flamethrowers and poison gas. They killed everyone in Trenton. We've got to get out of here, Mr. Chandler. They'll kill us all.
Enemy machines. Now,
no, I'm not terrible. It's just that...
Over houses and trees. Yes,
yes, I'll wait till you get here.
Then
hurry.
Hurry. Machines also sighted by telephone operator east of Middlesex, within 10 miles of Plainfield. Here's a bulletin from Winston Field, Long Island. Fleet of Army bombers carrying heavy explosive flying north in pursuit of enemy.
Army bombing plane V-843 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Vogt commanding 8 bombers reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. This is Vogt reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight, reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder, 6 altogether. One machine partially crippled, believed hit by shell from Army gun in Watchung Mountain. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme.
You want me to?
Yes, listen, this thing's gotten out of hand.
No sign of heat
break. The switchboard downstairs is flooded with coal. People will think it's the real McCoy. Oh, kid, I wish I were. It's an awful mess. I take care.
It was clearly an obvious play.
Well, I know that, but they don't.
What do you want me to do?
Can't you make some sort of announcement? Tell them it's just a dramatization.
Well, it's 3 minutes for the break. Tell them,
Do that, please. The switchboard operator is about ready to go out of their minds.
Plane circling. Ready to strike. 1,000 yards and we'll be over the first. 800 yards. 600. 400. 200. There they go. The giant arm raised. Green flash. They're spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left. Drop on them, plane and all. We're diving on the first one. The engine's gone. 8.
This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Come in, please. Come in, please.
This is Langham Field. Go ahead.
8 Army bombers in engagement with enemy tripod machines over Jersey Flats.
Threaten New Jersey, operator. How many times do I have to tell you?
Will you please hurry?
What do you mean you can't do it? You've got to get through.
Heavy black smoke in the direction.
The circuits are busy.
Come on, I got to call home, too.
Charlie? Hey, Charlie? Hey, where's Charlie going?
Well, Charlie's driving home with Dave.
Well, hurry up the phone, will you, please?
Warning. Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Reaches South Street. Gas masks useless. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use Route 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas. Smoke now spreading over Raymond Boulevard.
It's just a radio play, sir. State police. No, ma'am, it's just a radio play. State police. No, sir, it's just a No, sir, we have no official confirmation, but we believe it's just a radio play. Got anything yet, Browning?
No. Wait a minute, something's coming in now.
Hey, this is it.
State police. It's just a radio play, ma'am.
Attention, all units. Attention, all units.
We're not sure we think so.
There is no invasion from Mars. The invasion panic is the result of a radio broadcast. Repeat, there is no invasion from Mars. Proceed to distribute this information as quickly as possible.
Yes, sir, we're positive.
Attention, all units. Attention, all units.
I'm speaking from the roof of the broadcasting building, New York City. Bells you hear are ringing to warn people to evacuate the city as the Martians approach. Estimate that in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed.
All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army wiped out. Artillery, air force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end.
Oh, Jane, it's the end of the world. We're all going to die. I just heard it on the radio.
Give me a ticket. Anywhere. As far as this will take me. And hurry. The Martians are coming.
Black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River. Thousands of them dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke is crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. It's 100 yards away. 50 feet.
What on earth's the matter with you?
The baby! The monsters! The monsters are going to kill us!
Now, monsters, what monsters? What are you
talking about? The radio!
Radio?
Dead. The announcer must be dead.
2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Isn't there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone? 2X2L.
It's just a radio play, sir. The whole city must have gone nuts.
You mean the whole nation. The AP says the same thing is happening everywhere.
This is the lead story I wanted, and I can't even find time to remake the front page.
When is this ever going to end? It's just a radio play, man.
No, man. There is no invasion. It's just a radio play.
Engine Company 5 and Chemical 3 to Somerset and
Ward. Hey, where's Grover's Mills?
What?
We come to volunteer.
Volunteer?
Yeah, the nasty war place where they land.
Where's the Martians?
No, no, no.
Somerset and Ward.
There's no Martians. There's no Nazis. It's just a radio play. Now go home.
Mars. Repeat.
A radio
play? That's all. Now beat it. Get out of here.
But, Chief, it was clearly announced as a play. Here's a publicity release in tonight's paper. Now listen. When the Mercury Theater on the air broadcasts over the Columbia Network at 8 p.m., they will do H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. This is one of the first shows about Martians. It tells how the octopus-like creatures from Mars lay waste the Earth until there are only a few humans left. Yes, that's absolutely right. Every paper. Well, how clear can you make a thing? All they had to do was check. Nobody in his right mind would believe it.
Valley for 3 days. I'm getting hungry.
Hungry?
Yeah.
Well, I'm the one that's hungry. I tell you, Johnny, I'm so starved, I could almost...
Don't look at me that way. No, I'm just getting all surrogates.
Mary, what's the matter?
What's going on here? It's a meteor, sir.
No, those are Martians. They're running after us and destroying the world.
Martians, what are you talking about?
On the radio.
We've been listening to the radio ever since you left. We haven't heard anything about it.
I don't get it. It ought to be on every station, I'm sure.
Turn the TV off.
This is your host, ladies and gentlemen.
Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the next best thing.
We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Now, you will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it, and that both institutions are still open for business.
So, goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch. And if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
Why didn't you check the other stations?
Well, we didn't have time, sir. We were too busy listening.
You mean you really believed it?
Oh, you kids have got a lot to learn.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
It's all right, Millie. It's all over now. Are you sure, Mrs. Turner?
Yes, Millie.
Broadcasting system. For the listeners who tuned in to the Mercury Theater on the air broadcast tonight and did not realize that the program was merely a radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' famous novel, The War of the Worlds, we are repeating the fact, made clear four times on the program, that the entire content of the play was entirely fictitious.
But I don't understand.
Well, it was just a radio play, Millie.
I can't believe it. It's so real.
Ah, yes. It was so real. So real that it completely fooled poor Millie and more than a million others who slowly came to their senses and realized they'd been panicked by a colossal Halloween joke. And what were their reactions? Well, many laughed, with perhaps just a touch of hysterical relief in their laughter.
Me scared? Of course not. I knew it was a play all the time. Sure, me and the old woman, we run down the streets, mingle with the crowds, but we wasn't scared ourselves, just for the kicks. See how the others was taking it. You know what I mean.
Others were somewhat indignant.
A fine trick to play on people. My sister passed out. All the kids were screaming their heads off. The whole house was in an uproar. Is that what you call entertainment?
And still others were furiously angry.
Hello, CBS? Hey, what are you going to do about me? I'm 300 miles from home without a penny in my pocket. Where am I calling from? Buffalo, New York. That's where I'm calling from, and it's all your fault.
So the reactions of the period. But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear that did not know the atom bomb, guided missiles, and rockets that may shortly fly to the moon. 20 years ago, the concept of an alien race was novel to us, hence alarming. Today we realize that Mars is very near, closer perhaps in time than we imagine. There is every reason to believe that long before the Martians come to us, we will go to them. I wonder if we'll panic them as they did us on the night America trembled.